Hi, and welcome to the IBA Employment and Industrial Relations Committee podcast, working title
Conversations in Good Company.
My name is Mikko Konturi.
And my name is Veena Gopalakrishnan. And what we aim is to have candid conversations on employment law issues that keeps us busy, keeps us interested, and keeps us going.
We're glad you're listening, and we hope you like it.
For global organizations, workforce is more than just headcount. People are a critical and strategic asset. But what happens when business pressures, restructuring, or changing business models require optimization of human resources?
The question on how to manage global reductions or RIFs is becoming increasingly important for employers, especially with international footprint.
Many companies across industries are announcing major workforce cuts. RIFs are no longer isolated events driven purely by cyclic market fluctuations. They are increasingly becoming systemic approaches for organizations to reinvent their business models, align talent with new strategic priorities such as digital, AI, or sustainability, flatten outdated organizational structures, and reposition themselves for longer-term change. As you would all agree, what matters most is how these RIFs are executed. Legally compliant, culturally aware, and operationally coordinated across jurisdictions.
In this episode, we will discuss with our guests Lisa Lauritsen from Beck Prune, Denmark, Ed Mills from Traverse Mid, UK, Stephanie Tuck from Australia, Belgium, and Lauren Salt from ENS, South Africa, on this topic to gain insights on some of the distinctions and similarities across different jurisdictions.
First, we start off with trends. What is the global context of workforce reductions, and why has this become such a critical issue for international organizations? Across markets, we're seeing a combination of cost pressures, business model shifts, often driven by digital transformation or automation, and increased regulatory and stakeholder scrutiny of how such reductions are handled. To tie together the broader global numbers, some trackers indicate that in early 2025 alone, more than 76,000 job cuts were reported in certain sectors. While tech is a visible indicator, the trend is certainly not limited to it. We're seeing reductions in manufacturing, retail, and pretty much most public sector undertakings. My question for all of you is, what are the trends that each of you are seeing in your jurisdictions around workforce restructuring and reductions in force? This is clearly not new, right? Most businesses did have to reduce headcount at some point or the other. But is there any change or a systemic trend that is coming up in your jurisdictions? We'll start with you, Lauren.
Thanks, Veena. I think what we are seeing is exactly what you've mentioned, the combination of cost reduction with digitalization. And I think what we're seeing in South Africa is certainly that businesses are using the need to reassess and streamline their organizational structures as an opportunity to deal with other aspects of their business, not just the digital side and the digitalization of their workforce and what they do. So we see a combination of things, and in our retrenchments and redundancies, we are seeing just that in relation to the explanation. It will be cost efficiency plus digitalization and then potentially other factors as well.
Completely agree with that, Lauren. We're seeing the same in the UK. Certainly some initiatives that we've been involved in have been driven by AI digitalization, but I think lots of organizations did nothing in terms of adapting their workforce during the pandemic, maybe came out of the pandemic for a couple of years and then thought, this isn't quite right. So I think cost pressures coupled with modernization of the workforce means that we are seeing a lot of these exercises in the UK at the moment.
Yeah, well, picking up on what Ed just said, I think the pandemic has played a crucial role in what we are seeing in Denmark. I would say the most important trend we see is the increase in number of reductions carried out as mass redundancies. And those are cost-driven. We see a lot of cross-border redundancy exercises where functions are consolidated across border. And in my view, some of it comes out of the pandemic because physical presence is no longer an issue. So you can now have for instance, the HR function in another country than where the employees are actually based. So that's one of the trends in Denmark.
Well, I can only agree with what my colleagues have said, and maybe just across Europe. I think what I have seen is that companies are indeed under pressure, both financially and also because of the digital transformation. And I think a good example is indeed that large airline company who recently announced plans to reduce thousands of administrative roles through digitalization. And of course, these kind of changes, moves, they raise complex employment law questions. And then maybe for Belgium, but I think it also applies for other countries, is I've noticed that many companies are trying to reduce or manage workforce reductions, but in a way to avoid the formal collective dismissal procedures. Especially in Belgium, these procedures can be very lengthy and burdensome with a lot of union involvement, and so many companies in Belgium, they are trying to find other ways, let's say softer measures like hiring freezes, not renewing temporary contracts, or even trying to discuss voluntary exits, etc. And so what I have seen a lot is that companies, the focus is not only on cutting costs, but also doing it strategically and carefully, and of course, by always being compliant with the legal environment.
Okay, so we're moving on to a little bit more practical level. So can you tell us a little bit, what are the key legal obligations the employers face when they are planning substantial workforce reductions in your jurisdiction? So if Florian can start.
Yeah, and what we'd really like you to focus on is on something that is unique in your country. And when your client reaches out to you for a global reduction in force, what is that one thing that you will tell them about South Africa or each of your countries on what is it that they should do?
So we have a fairly stringent process to follow if you're looking at workplace reductions. And I think where a number of global organizations misstep is when you need to start that process. So South African law is specific in when you must start. And they say that you must issue the notice commencing consultation with the employees when retrenchment or redundancy moves from a possibility to a probability. And as soon as it becomes a probability, that triggers the statutory notice, and then the consultation process will commence. So I think that is the peculiarity that exists in South Africa, and something that we see a lot of issues with.
Yeah, so I can vouch for that, Lauren, actually, because we worked together, didn't we, on a combined UK and South African exercise. And I would say that's quite a key feature in the UK, particularly when we're dealing with, say, US parented clients, that they will often write a document, maybe a spreadsheet with all of the identified individuals, quite predetermined, disclosable paper trail can create real problems, because we have individual consultation in every case and you can't prejudge. Everything is a proposal until the final decision. The only other points I was going to make in the UK, that there's a bit more of a focus now on the collective regime, and we've got some changes coming in. Many of you have probably heard about our employment rights bill that's coming in over the next sort of couple of years. We do think some significant changes will come in, and most notably, actually, well, as well as the protective award for getting it wrong, going up from 90 days pay to 180 days pay per employee, it's now going to be the case that when you're assessing whether the duty to collectively consult has been triggered, you have to aggregate separate locations in the UK. So the test has always been, is it 20 or more redundancies within a 90-day period from the same establishment? There's going to be a new addition to the law which says that for multi-site businesses in the UK, including retail, where perhaps if you were making 10 to 15 redundancies across 20 or 30 shops, that would not be caught currently. That will be aggregated, so you'll get many more collective processes arising.
Well, from a Danish perspective, normally when having cross-border redundancy processes, it will be Denmark adapting to the other jurisdictions' timeline. Luckily, the kickoff time is the same as in the UK and the South Africa. But except for that, we can finish it off within a few days. That is what makes us unique, I think, in that perspective.
And so in Belgium, I mentioned it before, but our system is very union-driven. And so trade unions, they play an important role in collective redundancy procedures. One example is that the unions will force companies to negotiate a social plan. And a social plan usually includes financial and social measures that go beyond what is required by law. And the outcome of such a social plan really depends not only on the company's financial situation, but also how strong the unions are in a specific sector. And so if they're in a specific sector, there are very strong unions, they will really force employers to pay much more to employees who are dismissed within a collective dismissal above what they are legally required to do. And so it can become very expensive for a company to proceed with a collective dismissal. And another specific unique thing in Belgium is that unions also protect their representatives very strongly. This means that if, for instance, you within a collective dismissal, you need or you want to terminate a works council member, you need to have prior approval from the joint committee to do so. And that means that And the unions are part of the joint committee, and you need a unanimous vote to be able to terminate the contract. So basically, there again, you need the unions on your side to be able to terminate the contract of a works council member. And again, they use their power in order to obtain other elements more than what the employer is legally required to do. And that's something that for Belgium and pure, let's say, pure Belgium employers, they know it. But for, let's say, if we advise US clients, this is important for them to understand the effective role and the important role of unions in collective dismissal procedures.
This is so interesting. Given the context of this podcast is global redundancies, so we are when your client reaches out to you saying this is something that we're planning to do across each of our jurisdictions in the next 6 months, several thousands of jobs are going to be eliminated. What is it that you would flag off as risk hotspots, real legitimate risks as opposed to theoretical risks?
Well, from a Danish perspective, and as I said before, we can do a speedy process, which means also that some other jurisdictions involved in a cross-border redundancy process might need to initiate their process before the Danish process is initiated. So keeping the information behind closed doors is one of the hotspot risks as I see it, and getting increasingly more risky. Because, for instance, we see a lot of cross-border redundancies in the Nordic region, that if the employees in Sweden get the information before the employees in Denmark, well, the employees in Denmark will know for sure within the day, the next day at least. So that's at least one risk that we do see.
Yeah, and also in Belgium, and I think more largely, I think one of the biggest challenges is indeed there are differences in this information and consultation timing and process. And for instance, in Belgium, it's very important to know that we have legislation saying that our works council must be informed about any important changes, restructurings before any public announcement. So it is very important that if, for instance, a group announces a group level restructuring in another country first, that can cause real problems in Belgium, because unions and also the members of the Works Council, they may claim that you did not comply with your information and consultation rules. And that can, of course, trigger social unrest or even legal challenges, because when they hear it from colleagues abroad or even read it in the press before they have been informed within the Works Council, that can really be a big issue. And so I think, yeah, those differences in timing and process, that's what I think that many companies, many groups struggle with, to in order to really say, okay, we need to comply with all the different timelines, with all the different legal obligations and procedures.
I think I can echo some of the other risks, but one thing we see a lot of is where there's a transaction, a global transaction occurs, there is often a risk of misstepping on competition moratoriums on redundancies, particularly where there's a post-transaction integration. And how that plays out will be that there is a global transaction, post-transaction, there is an integration of one company into another, into either one of them or a new company, and then all of a sudden everybody forgets about the moratorium on retrenchment that the Competition Commission had issued previously. And then everybody seems to also forget our prevention of terminations relating to a transfer of a business or a service as a going concern. So our South Africa's version of a CHUPI style transaction, that all seems to go out of the window. And in our regime, a dismissal related to a transaction is automatically unfair and attracts higher penalties. So I think that's one of the things that's a real pain point for us.
In the UK, I think we're seeing many more complaints being raised in respect of redundancies, not just collective redundancies, individual redundancies. I think we're going to come on and talk a little bit about selection criteria and some of the risks involved with those. But certainly where there has been a selection process, we're seeing many more grievances or attempts to appeal, often turning into litigation, often accompanied by a data subject access request under GDPR. So something that seems quite sort of straightforward and inherently fair is being challenged.
What are the selection criteria? If we could quickly touch upon that in each of your countries, and perhaps Mikko, is there something in Helsinki that companies need to follow?
Well, basically, if you are considering some reductions to your workforce, you can pretty much make the selection as you wish. But there are some certain group of employees that are under protection. For example, if you are on your family leave, for example, then you have to wait until it's over and that kind of rules. But other than that, it's pretty free.
So in South Africa, our regime says that you must have either agreed selection criteria or, if failing that, fair and objective selection criteria. So we have some guidance on what that looks like. It is retention of skills. It is last in, first out, LIFO. There is an opportunity to have a combination of selection criteria as long as it doesn't fall foul of what is fair. So you can add things like performance. You can add things like employment equity, which is our affirmative action regime. So if you are selecting candidates, if there's two candidates that are potentially affected by the redundancy, you can select the one that promotes your affirmative action plan in the workplace.
Okay.
Not alone, but in combination with other factors. So alone, it may be discriminatory, but in combination with other factors, and it is the only decider between the two, then it would be fair.
I always advise my clients in Belgium to really start by clearly defining the selection pool and also the business rationale behind the decision, and then basically try to build a matrix based on objective criteria like skills, qualifications, consistent performance, but also how critical a certain role is for the business. And it's important to avoid, of course, criteria that could lead to discrimination. We have also an increase in discrimination claims in Belgium in the last couple of years. So it's important to avoid criteria like age, health status, pregnancy, even union activity or type of contract. But it's also important to keep evidence of your decisions, and again, I'm coming back to unions and employee representatives. But if they want to understand the criteria you use, that you share that information indeed with the employee representatives and the unions.
So in the UK, I would say the thing to be aware of is that lots of employers do this really badly, I would say, that despite what we tell them to do and many offers of drafting and reviewing, they still often do it quite badly. So watch out, particularly with the environment I touched on of people bringing more claims about this. And it's interesting, Lauren, that you talked about LIFO, last in, first out. We don't use that anymore because it's inherently indirectly age discriminatory. So discriminates, you know, on average more against young people. Occasionally businesses will use it as a tiebreaker, but less and less so. Absence, again, has a disability discrimination risk. So I think what I'm seeing, probably what I'm advising, because when we've had cases before the employment tribunals, these types of criteria go down quite well. And those are criteria that are linked to, if possible, the performance review process. So essentially, if you've got a well-developed review process with, you know, sort of skills and experience based material within it, then leverage that, because actually it's the best information you've got and it's the least open to challenge. Because, you know, if the performance review has been signed off and then it's accurately replicated in the criteria scoring, then it's quite hard for the employee to challenge it.
Denmark is more or less similar to what you already said, all of you. It is for the employer to choose the criteria that will be applied. They have to be fair and objective. It is important to be able to document that you have applied fair and objective criteria and how you applied them. So we normally set up a scoreboard, so to speak, for our clients and assist them in setting up the criteria. But as you said, Ed, when applying them, they might fail anyway. And such criteria could be competences, education, seniority, could be flexibility, and certainly performance. Yeah. It mirrors more or less, I think, what's already been said.
As a last question, from your collective experience, what are the must-do steps for employer planning RIFs to minimize associated risks? Are there any do's and don'ts that you always say to your clients?
If you have got problems, settle quickly. So often in these global redundancies, Ed mentioned it earlier, there is a list setting out the individuals who've been identified. There is nothing precluding you in South Africa from commencing voluntary settlement discussions prior to starting the formal retrenchment consultation. So if you've got some of those risks, rather deal with them up front. Otherwise, you run the risk of a very contentious retrenchment process.
For Belgium, or I think even generally, I always consider the must-dos to plan early and to prepare a playbook, and also to map out the legal obligations for each country that is involved. I think that's very important. And then, of course, to align the timing of the communications, but also the content of the communications that you need to do across all the different jurisdictions. And also to coordinate public disclosures or public communications with legal requirements, of course, to avoid reputational and compliance risks. And then don't improvise or leave planning to the last minute. That's, of course, that relates to the must-do, is like plan well in advance. And don't make premature or inconsistent announcements. Also, I think it's important that never assume that a one-size-fits-all will work. And that's, again, important to understand the legal obligations in all of the different countries.
Well, in Denmark, we would normally, as you said, for Belgium, say, well, please plan carefully and as early as possible. But also keep an open mind as employer when negotiating and consulting with the employee representatives. Listen carefully to what they want for their colleagues that are to be terminated, not only to assist the ones that needs to find a new job, but also to keep up the morale for the employees being left in the company. To see that if at some point in time I should be the one being terminated, my employer will treat me fairly on my way out.
In respect of multinational exercises, that's going to include not just the legal requirements, but also, you know, an awareness of the local cultural issues as well, because they sometimes get overlooked. Linked to that, I guess, you know, mistakes that can be made, certainly in those global exercises, one size fits all, as Stephanie said, is a no-no. And we found quite a good way of dealing with that, actually, is to set out the proposed process that we think the client wants to follow, and then send that out to local counsel with a fairly targeted set of questions. You know, does this type of process work? If we had these types of letters, would that work? You know, what would we expect by way of severance? Those types of things. So necessarily the process will need to adapt. But yeah, hopefully it will be largely the sort of core process in the middle of it. And then, yeah, I guess the only other risk we touched on earlier is predetermination. We see it so often, a disclosable paper trail is created. And once that's there, if the employees or the reps can get hold of it, it renders anything that you've done subsequently as a sham, really. Yeah. The whole process becomes worthless. So, you know, the lesson, I guess, for clients is don't commit stuff to writing unless you have to. Clearly, there will be some documents you need, but they should be very much couched in terms of proposals rather than decisions.
All right. So thank you very much for this really interesting conversation. As always, there's some similarities and there's a lot of distinctions. So I hope that this episode was useful for all the listeners. And thank you for listening.